pointed out that
on this and other things, Eliot, in fact, is very evasive. This is nice if those of you who are interested in Eliot. It's not specifically important for our course. But that he appears, at any rate, in certain places, to have said that the last poet in English poetry in whom sensibility was not dissociated was John Donne. That is to say, 1670 to 1570 to 1630. That seems to be the period at which, after that, things go wrong for Eliot. Yeats, I pointed out, had the same view, but pushed it a little further back. He, for him, the ideal age appears to have been the Italy of the 16th century, and we shall see more of that in a little while. The ducal courts of Urbino and Florence in the 16th century. For Pound, and this is where we come near to the Pre-Raphaelites, Pound, as I did say, in fact, pushes it back further still. For him, the age is the age of the late 14th and 15th century, and something goes wrong when you get, already when you get into the 16th century. In this respect, Pound is the most Pre-Raphaelite of them all. From the 17th and the 18th century, the consummation of the Italian Renaissance in painting, though it is taken as sort of painting is taken as the register which marks the cultural apex in all the arts, is in fact the famous painter Raphael of Urbino in the early 16th century. In the mid-19th century, however, a body of people in England who were themselves principally painters or hoped to be principally painters arrived at the different perception that in fact Pound was to have. No, the best of Italian painting was that pre-Raphael. That is to say, painters who by the admirers of Raphael of the 18th century had been regarded as primitives leading up to the maturity of Raphael, and also incidentally of Michelangelo. They are virtual contemporaries to all intents and purposes, but Raphael is always taken. Now, for those who know, perhaps the most striking example of this sort of person is, in fact, Botticelli. And I dare say most people have seen reproductions of Botticelli's great paintings, the Primavera and so on. You can see perfectly well how an old-fashioned attitude to painting, which believes that the achievement of the illusion of, like the theatrical illusion, realistic illusion that you're seeing a real person in a real place in real perspective. If that is what painting is chiefly concerned to do, then plainly Raphael and Michelangelo are advances upon Botticelli and other names that could go with it, chiefly 15th century Florentines. On the other hand, of course, if you suppose that the creation of an illusion of seeing a real person in a real room, real person in a real room, is not the be-all and end-all, or even the principal endeavour of painting, then you will look at a painting like Botticelli, which quite plainly is not aiming at anything of that sort at all, which has, is it deliberately stylized painting, and you will tend to think that, no, the so-called primitives, in fact, are the truly sophisticated and cultivated. And it is the beginnings of illusionistic realism, which then becomes virtually a falling away. This is the sense, therefore, in which they are called the Pre-Raphaelite movement. They believed, on the whole, that. They deliberately set themselves to school to the Pre-Raphaelite Italian painters, the very early Renaissance painters, even we might say the medieval painters, like Botticelli and earlier, like Giotto. And In the case of the most important of them, William Morris, and even more important, really, the Anglo-Italian family of the Rossettis, that is Gabriel Rossetti. The interesting thing is that they are painters, but they are also poets, and hence the same impetus can be seen both in their painting and in their poetry. In just the same way as they are not in their painting interested in producing a realistic illusion, but rather an emblematic, hieratic, stylized picture, so in their poetry, the same. The Rossetti family is, they're English, the family was originally Italian, but they weren't Italian. Extraordinarily talented. Dante Gabriel is perhaps the biggest of the three that we need to remember, but his brother, William Michael Rossetti, is also an important figure in literary history, and so is his sister, Christina Rossetti, who would have to be mentioned along with Elizabeth Barrett Browning and Emily Bronte. Those are perhaps the three most remarkable women poets of the Victorian age, or some of their poems have or ought to have a secure place in the canon of English poetry. Rossetti was the central figure. He was very closely associated with William Morris. You must have seen their paintings, reproductions of them. They enjoy a considerable vogue at the moment, in any case. And in particular, there is a characteristic sort of female beauty which they treat of, which does quite plainly go back to the women that one sees in Botticelli, Botticelli's Venus. And they spent a lot of time, as it were, finding women in late Victorian London who could serve as models and who had the same sort of beauty, a very peculiar beauty, very tall, elongated, etiolated, usually they're tubercular. as usual with painters and poets, the relationship between artist and model got mixed up with the relationship between man and mistress, so that their sexual and social lives were considerably disordered. Both for their paintings and for their poetry, they were in fact attacked as grossly immoral. Famous slashing attack of 1870 by George Buchanan, the fleshly school of English poetry. So they are important people. They, quite apart from the fact that the work that they some of the paintings and some of the poems are of permanent importance, but historically they have great importance too, because we're talking about a period now of the 1855 to 75 is their heyday, and they were, earlier than one might suppose, therefore, protesting against and deliberately outraging the moral and social prejudices of their time. In this sense, they are quite properly to be considered modernists. There are whole courses about this taught in this department, used by Mrs. Delphi. And so what I'm talking about now, what I'm giving you now, is a very, very sketchy introduction to it. And some of you, I'm sure, know a great deal more. I put another name up, Edward Burne-Jones. I would die at the stake for art's sake, said Rossetti in anguished tones. Said Hunt, I've got a better stamp, Burne-Jones. Holman Hunt.
One of the famous clever Hughes.
Now, these are the central figures, but they are the theorists of the movement. Rossetti himself was quite a notable theorist, but the theorists of the movement were, in the first place, Ruskin, John Ruskin. And in the later generation, Walter Pater. Now, this is complicated. Ruskin did realize, and was a wonderful critic of painting, particularly of objects to antique literature, he did understand what these pre-Raphaelites were up to very early on, when they were still Oxford undergraduates, about 1860, and he did stand up for them and attempt to explain. But on the other hand, he was himself an extreme, almost frantic moralist, particularly towards the end of his life, when he was really not altogether sane. So his relationship with the movement was a tormented one. He began as its champion, but when once he saw that there was an element of moral outrage, he backed off from it. Walter Pater is the most important figure. Spent his whole life as a bachelor Oxford dom. His studies in the Renaissance is a book that everybody should have read before they go down with a major in English. And indeed there are other books too, extraordinarily influential in his time. And in fact, among other things, for instance, there are two other names which we must write out here. The first is of a poet who was never quite a Pre-Raphaelite as such, but who was in sympathy with it and moved in the same circles, and who, at any rate in his youth, which was more extended, had more power, most people would say, more poetic power than any of them, and this was Algernon Charles Swinburne. Pater and Ruskin, both teaching at Oxford, when the brilliant student from Dublin, Oscar Wilde, went to study in Oxford after being at Trinity College Dublin. He studied at Oxford, and he studied immediately under Pater, but he also attended lectures by Ruskin. And so there is an immediate, through Wilde particularly, but also through some others, there is an immediate link between this generation and the next, the 1890s, and the people that Yeats himself knew in his youth in London, as you know from reading the autobiographies. A great deal of Wilde's life and the drama of it can be explained in terms of his trying to make sense of the dual teachings he got from Ruskin on the one hand and from Pater on the other. Because the moralism of Ruskin and the amoralism of Pater. Now, this you had to be very careful about, because Pater himself was a very timid man and was an entirely proper Oxford don. And although the implications of what he taught was in fact amoral, if not immoral, Pater himself was always very, very careful never quite to say it. Wilde, and this is what makes Wilde more than just a notorious figure, it makes him, in a sense, almost in his flawed way, a heroic figure. He takes the implications of what we now are calling the aesthetic movement and pushes it to its limit until, of course, he, in fact, forced showdown in the famous trial when, if you don't remember, it was he first who brought a libel action against someone who had said that he was a practicing homosexual. And he was. He lost the libel action and he, as it were, brought down the whole force of outraged Victorian feeling upon himself. So there is an element of almost deliberately sought martyrdom in Oscar Wilde's career. Yeats was aware of this, as you will see from certain pages of the autobiography. So I think one says that the pre-Raphaelite movement became the aesthetic movement. Rossetti is particularly interesting because he did, and he's not given enough credit for this now, quite apart from his own poems, he's one of the very greatest verse translators. He translated an enormous body of the medieval Italian poetry, the early Italian poets, up to and including Dante. This had an immediate effect, not only upon Yeats, but even more, in fact, upon Pound. William Morris was indeed a poet and painter, but he had early on, he differed from the rest in having, from quite early on, a strong social conscience. He was himself a rich man, very, very well healed, but he had a very interesting, he took off from a side of Ruskin, in fact, which has to do precisely with the relationship of the arts to society and how they can be better integrated into society. And what is the significance, for instance, of the craft, the applied art? And Morris, who was an extremely energetic man, a good, keen businessman, among other things, in fact, instituted, there have been lectures about this, and perhaps this is what you were being lectured about by the one from Princeton. There have been lectures about it here instead of this quarter. He instituted his own small factories for the production of wallpapers, tapestries, and also later for the printing and producing of very beautiful books, the William Morris factories. Factories we must be careful about. He agreed with Ruskin, or he learned from Ruskin, that the processes of fully industrialized production were in fact dehumanizing to the operators, and also could produce only second-rate art, that first-rate art or crafts, first-rate products, could be produced only if it was, if the craftsman was himself involved and it was done by hand manually. Morris, a very practical man, believed this, on the other hand, realized the necessity for making a going business venture of it, and these industrial undertakings of Morris are a very intelligent attempt, and a very successful attempt, really, for many years, to use some of the capitalist techniques for financing production, while at the same time retaining the virtues which he and Ruskin agreed in seeing, the virtues of the craftsman working by hand, a small group of them, as in the medieval guild, the master and his apprentices working together in a shop. Morris is also revered, and this again is something that puts him apart from the rest. His thinking along these lines finally made him one of the earliest English socialists, and quite an active one. He was a political speaker and a political pamphleteer. And it was only in his later period, of course, that the young Yeats knew him, when most of his poems and paintings were behind him, and when he was very much a social, political, and economic innovator. His poems are not to us, I think, most people would say, very interesting. He reasonably enough said, well, if it is true, as I firmly believe in that talk, there were virtues in the later Middle Ages which we lost, and you can see this most plainly in painting, I think it would seem to follow therefore that the same thing must be true in poetry. So he applied himself to writing, to recreating for the 19th century those characteristic forms of medieval poetry, whether in English, French, Italian, other languages, long verse romances in many books. Again, very intelligent. It was a perfectly intelligent reading of cultural history. And so they have certainly great historical importance. And they can, in fact, be read in short gulps with pleasure, but they just go on for a long time. I mean, I think the sort of model that we might draw from this part of the board that I scribbled on, is that we are quite wrong to suppose that modernism was something that suddenly happened, that it was introduced into England by two Americans, Eliot and Pound, and an Irishman, Yeats. That, you know, there came a time at which the curtain was rung down on the Victorian age and the curtain rose again on us, and our majesty. This, of course, is not true. Cultural history doesn't operate in this way. You can, in fact, find some, quite a lot, in fact, of what we tend to think of as the characteristic convictions and concerns of modern artists, 20th century artists like Yeats and Pound, as far back as 1855 in England. And this isn't to take account of comparable, though different, developments that were taking place across the Channel in France at the same period. In other words, when you begin to look really for the springs of what we may call modernism, you go a heck of a long way.
Separates itself from religion just after the Renaissance, and also in the trembling of the veil, in Ireland and the arts, he sort of is bemoaning the fact that art and life have separated themselves too far. And yet, it seems William Morris is accomplishing some of this unity by combining art and utility, and yet Yeats broke with it. Isn't that a contradiction?
I think it's quite a contradiction. I also don't think it's quite right to say that Yeats broke with him. You know, he followed with him. I think you're right to insist that there is this continuity, that we've seen Yeats already moving in this way. He's not satisfied with art as such, distinct from society. In order that he should be able to produce, and others should be able to produce the art that he wants, this involves the society in keeping. In this way, he is indeed precisely like William Morris, like John Ruskin. However, as you say, it's in the essay Ireland and the Art when that we see this perhaps most clearly and explicitly, and the difference is, again, the difference between Ireland and England. And that's to say, Yeats might very well have maintained that Morris's way of healing, or beginning to heal, the gulf between art and society made sense in terms of British society. It did not make sense in terms of Irish. Remember, I mean, because 19th century Britain was the most advanced industrial capitalist country in the world. Ireland, for reasons which we know about, in fact, had virtually no capitalist or industrial development at all, except in the northeast. Plus, this made an enormous difference. We have this. So Yeats feels in that essay, Ireland and the Arts, and in other essays of this sort, that Ireland has a chance to avoid the mistakes, or at any rate, the disastrous consequences that had made Ruskin, Pater, Morris, cry out upon the sheer hideousness, the sheer unsightliness to sight and of sight and sound that, in fact, unrestricted capitalist industrial development had brought upon England, with characteristically disastrous effects also upon people's sensibility. And, in fact, Yeats's subsequent bitterness, which we're going to see very plainly in these poems we're looking at now, with the Irish, resides in his sense that, yes, Ireland did have this chance and turned it up. Once Ireland got her freedom, she changed herself as fast as she could into a 20th century bourgeois capitalist state. There are many other speculations about this, and I think one must not be misled. But I mean, it is worth remembering that Morris was a socialist, but it would be false to suppose that British socialism, as we now have it, in power in England, is therefore still operating on William Morris's programs. On the contrary, in that sense, so there is a clear line of development from Morris into the Fabian Society and into the early trade union movement, and so into the British Labour Party and the British Labour governments that we've had. In fact, there are some drastic disjunctions and discontinuities along the way. Morris really represents an idealistic and indeed an aesthetic socialism, in which, although it is still honoured by modern British socialists, in fact, operates very little in actual modern British socialism. This whole picture is, after all, something that we are familiar enough with, even here on the Stamford campus, of the people who come with rugs and candles to sell them on White Plaza. Whether they know it or not, are really operating, those of them who really know what the heck it is they're doing, are really operating out of the same cluster of concerns that we associate with these big Victorian English figures. The whole notion of copping out and going to live in Mendocino and running a small commune and growing your own apples and keeping your own hens and weaving a serape for and so on, crafts, withdrawal into the rural and the simple, and restoring the relationship between the person and the materials, and making production actually a satisfying and fulfilling activity. Well, this is still very alive, not just in this country, say in England and Wales too. And really, it does go back to this cluster of concerns that is represented by these names. So that it's not dead history. I mean, where lots of people still find themselves caught in the same tangle of concern and conviction and idealism which we associate with John Ruskin or William Morris or D.G. Rossetti in the 1860s. And the influence of Walter Pater it can hardly be overestimated in Yeats. I must try to remember when come to it, and when there comes an appropriate moment to point it out to you. Again, let me remind you that this is, in fact, one way into Yeats. I could have started this course by building up this English 19th century and then moving into Yeats this way. This is what? It's a perfectly valid way of proceeding. It's the way I think most people proceed when they are treating him historically. The difficulty with it is, as I say, that leaves people to forget that he's an Irishman. Not just a special sort of Englishman, but an Irishman, which makes a great difference. Any more questions about that? Or about anything else? Well, I'm glad we had that discussion. Poems and Responsibilities, we have looked at many of these already. Pardon Old Fathers, the section printed in italics on page 38, we have looked at in terms of the first Yeats who came, the old Dublin merchant, free of the 10 and 4. You remember that Yeats couldn't remember what that meant. He remembers other people in his ancestry. You remember that a butler or an Armstrong that withstood beside the brackish waters of the Boyne James and his Irish when the Dutchman crossed. Comically, he thought at first they fought on the other side. A
And then, I have no child, I have nothing but a book, nothing but that to prove your blood and mine, in 1914, when he was in the late 40s. September 1913, similarly, on page 39, we have, not very long ago, in fact, found and identified O'Leary, the Wild Geese, Edward Fitzgerald, Robert Emmett, Wolf Tone, and that poem should be clear enough, therefore. It is a poem, one of the early poems of fierce rejection with what he saw Independent Ireland becoming. To a friend whose work has come to nothing, on page 40, is to Lady Gregory. You remember, Lady Gregory now becomes a very important influence in Yeats, which has referred to her time and again up to her death in 1930. You remember from the early moments of the movie that we saw, before we moved in on County Sligo, we had some shots of Cool Park, in County Galway, some 100 miles south of Sligo, where which was Lady Gregory's house, and you will remember perhaps particularly a shot of the famous tree in whose bark in the park of Cool House. In the bark there are all the initials Yeats's, George Moore's, Shauna Case's, A.E.'s, George Bernard Shaw's, all inscribed in the bark of this famous tree. You remember the shot? Well, this, then, she did, in fact, for as long as she was there at Cool Park, in the period we're talking about, did, in fact, establish, almost one might say, a little court. She was a patron of the art and herself an artist. She collected Irish stories and poems. Yeats went with her on some of her expeditions as she moved around finding old people who would talk old traditional stories in English. And they would take them down. She did take them down, and there are several volumes of Lady Gregory's collections, which are still to be found in the library. She also collaborated actively with Yeats and Synge in the founding of the Abbey Theatre. She wrote plays of her own, some of which are still produced, many of which are still readable. A very interesting woman, and you may ask, well, what sort of an Irish woman was she? Presumably Anglo-Irish. Yes, indeed, Anglo-Irish, and of a sort that we've not perhaps yet quite focused, though it's a very important sort of Anglo-Irish indeed. She was the widow of a man called Sir William Gregory, who, an Anglo-Irish Protestant, and they'd come over after Cromwell, they were Cromwellian planters. Sir William was in fact knighted by the British for his distinguished work in the British colonial service. And in fact, he retired as governor of Ceylon. And there is a whole tradition of this sort of Anglo-Irishman. And this is, as it were, a more extreme example of the split personality of the Anglo-Irishman than perhaps we've yet become aware of. Though it occurs, as I pointed out that Field Marshal Lord Montgomery was an Irishman as well as a British general. Richard Murphy, whose poems we looked at briefly earlier this quarter, I mean, some of them we looked at, you remember the one about Derry, and who is teaching this year in Princeton, I think. His father, Sir William Murphy, similarly, was born in a country rectory in Ireland, ended his days as governor of the Bahamas, and so Richard was brought up as a child a child of the colonial overlords, mostly left in charge of Indian or Ceylonese or African nursemaids, and he has poems about this too. Sir William, instead of returning to Ireland, as would have been normal, in fact, settled when he retired. rigid to come home and try to make sense of being the highly specialized sort of Anglo-Irishman that he was in Republican Ireland. Well, this was true of Lady Gregory too. She was, you see, a most active and patriotic Irish woman, though she took no part in and had no sympathy with the revolutionary movement for separation from the crown. Well, I would say she had no sympathy, but she had no active political sympathy. Indeed, she represented, as it were, for the really rabid IRA types, she represented precisely the iron hand of the occupying power. There's a wonderful story told of her. It crops up in one of the Yeats poems, too. You shall see it. In the height of the Troubles, she was told that she had been, that she'd been marked down for, she was going to be assassinated. I think this was, yeah. And she said, she let it be known that she sat every evening for an hour in front of a lighted window. All right, come and get me. Very wonderful woman, really. Her son, Robert Gregory, Major Robert Gregory, is the subject of two very important poems by Yeats, which we shall be looking at very shortly, a long elegy in memory of Major Robert Gregory, and a short one called The Irish Airman Foresees His Death, which again is extraordinarily interesting, because when the First World War happened, Gregory, in fact, joined the Royal Flying Corps, though an Irishman, of course, as happens at all in the British Wars, joined the Royal Flying Corps, was in action, and in fact was shot down and killed over the Italian front. So The Irish Airman Foresees His Death is brief and bitter little lyric in which Yeats honours this young man of great talent and promise, and at the same time does explain in a very compressed way the sort of central paradox of his dying when he did. He makes him say, I am fighting for those who are not my people are back home, I am fighting against those who are not my enemies, so why do I do it? He found it a lonely impulse of delight drove to this tumult in the cloud. And so, Lady Gregory, to a friend whose work has come to nothing, she'll crop up in many other places. To a shade is, you remember, to Parnell, and a very bitter poem indeed. The second section of it, the first is about Parnell. If you have revisited the town Thin Shade, they aren't their own tricks yet. Then a second, a man of your own passionate serving kind who had brought in his full hands what, had they only known, had given their children's children loftier thought. Sweeter emotion working in their veins like gentle blood has been driven from the place and insult heaped upon him for his pains and for his open-handedness, disgrace. This is a man whom you need to remember, Hugh Lane, I mentioned him once before. Another of the Anglo-Irish, who was a great collector of paintings, had a priceless collection of Impressionist paintings, wanted to give them to Dublin, asked only that the Dublin municipal authorities build a gallery on the Liffey fit to house them. They hummed and hawed and finally refused it. Lane, therefore, went away and gave them to the Tate Gallery in London. As a note about that and about these several poems in the collected poems, To a Shade and some others that in fact are not printed in your selection. This was written in 1914 by Yeats, when he printed them first. In the 30 years or so during which I have been reading Irish newspapers, three public controversies have stirred my imagination. The first was the Parnell controversy. There were reasons to justify a man's joining either party, but there were none to justify, on one side or on the other, lying accusations, forgetful of past service, a frenzy of detraction. That's the first. And another was the dispute over the Playboy, the Western world. There may have been reasons for opposing, as for supporting, that violent, laughing thing, though I can see the one side only, but there cannot have been any for the lies, for the unscrupulous rhetoric spread against it in Ireland and from Ireland to America. The third prepared for the corporation's refusal of a building for Sir Hugh Lane's famous collection of pictures. Then he has, these controversies, he goes on, political, literary, and artistic, have showed that neither religion nor politics can of itself create minds with enough receptivity to become wise or just and generous enough to make a nation. Other cities have been as stupid, but Dublin is the capital of a nation, and an ancient race has nowhere else to look for an education. In Ireland, I am constantly reminded of the futility of all discipline that is not of the whole being. Religious Ireland, and the pious Protestants of my childhood were signal examples, thinks of divine things as a round of duties separated from life, and not as an element that may be discovered in all circumstance and emotion, while political Ireland sees the good citizen but as a man who holds to certain opinions and not as a man of goodwill. Against all this, we have but a few educated men and the remnants of an old traditional culture among the poor. Both were stronger 40 years ago, before the rise of our new middle class, which made its first public display during the 9 years of the Parnellite split, showing how base at moments of excitement are minds without culture. By that time, 1914, when he wrote these poems and first printed them, his anger and arrogant condemnation of the middle class, and the Irish middle class in particular, is already quite explicit. And already he's looking for his alternative. His alternative was to, he's going to lay enormous, put enormous faith in Lady Gregory and the class which she represents. An aristocracy, a gentry, with country houses which can be set up, an alternative elitist centre to the cities like Dublin. And we shall talk a great deal more about that tomorrow, I guess. Another thing we'll talk about tomorrow is a passage which I have here which I'd like you to pick up before you go. A passage of Ezra Pound about W.B. Yeats. Poems from Responsibilities, page 40, and where we've about got to, and I hope you've got that curious sheet which I gave you yesterday. I talked about to a friend whose work has come to nothing on the top of page 40, explaining that that was addressed to Lady Gregory. We talked a little about who Lady Gregory was and her significance, both as a person and as a representative of an Irish type in Yeats's life. We shall see further poems to her and to her son, Major Robert Gregory, who was shot down over the Italian front in 1915. Below that is Poor Dean, which is an open piece of, begins at any rate as an open piece of invective against the lower middle class, the shopkeeper class, which Yeats was increasingly disliking. To a Shade, we have talked about. This is also written bitterly against the Dublin shopkeepers, who it begins, the Shade is the Shade of Parnell. He is invoked, he is told that they are at their old tricks yet. The second section, as I mentioned, is about Hugh Lane, the man who tried to give them some paintings, which but they wouldn't build a gallery for them. And I read the note that Yeats had to this poem and to several others, a group of poems in which he is quite explicit about quite explicitly links Parnell, the way that public opinion,
particularly working through the rabid newspapers, destroyed Pardell's political career, and links that with the way in which ignorant opinion failed to respond to John Manitin Singh's Playboy of the Western World, and the third example he gives is of the way that Hugh Lane's bequest was effectively turned down. An insult heaped upon him for his pains and for his open-handedness, disgrace. Your enemy, an old fouled mouth, had set the pack upon him. Go, unquiet wanderer. For what it's worth, the old enemy, the man who had attacked Pardell and who survived to attack Lane, was a man called William Martin Murphy. Go, unquiet wanderer, and gather the Glasnevin coverlet about your head until the dust stops your ear. Glasnevin, as I mentioned on one occasion, is one of the large cemeteries.